This is Ricardo Vaz. I'm an editor at Venezuela Analysis. And Sine and I have a great episode for you as we bring the Iranian-Venezuelan solidarity into the realm of podcasts. So we talk about the latest developments in Venezuela. We talk about Hugo Chavez, who he was, what he meant, and what the Bolivarian Revolution was all about. So make sure to subscribe to Sine's Patreon so you can listen to this episode as well as all the other great content he's bringing up all the time.
You're officially a friend of the show, Ricardo, but just in case people don't know you, can you introduce yourself and tell us about your wonderful podcast that people are going to pause and go and subscribe to as they hear this?
Yeah, I expect crowds to storm into our podcast and subscribe. So yeah, I'm Ricardo Vaz. I'm an editor at Venezuela Analysis. Always great to be here. One of my favorite podcasts, and I'm sure everyone's favorite. And yeah, we recently launched a podcast of our own, which is much more narrow because we are a Venezuela-focused outlet. But we try to compensate that by going in depth into several topics. So it's once a month, and we just released one today on feminist struggle here in Venezuela, since it's International Working Women's Day. So you can check that out. And the previous one was on peasant struggles, on struggles on the countryside, kind of giving it a broader perspective in the context of the Bolivarian Revolution and also its historical precedence. So yeah, I mean, we are still finding our way, but we are very, very excited that, I mean, this is another way to reach people right now. I mean, we can't discard one avenue and just focus on the other. We need to be on every screen and on every outlet available.
Well, there's actually a lot happening in Venezuela at the moment. There's been a lot of developments, even in the last couple of days. Maybe in the first half, I mean, I know we were going to talk about Chavismo. That's ultimately the goal of this episode. But maybe at the beginning, you can update us on what's been happening. The U.S. has made a remarkable gesture towards the actual president of Venezuela.
Yeah, I mean, when we look at it, it sounds like a U.S. effort to sabotage our Chavismo episodes. But if you look beyond it, then yeah, I mean, it was totally unexpected. We started hearing these rumors, and I think it was the New York Times who broke it, that there was a U.S. delegation coming to Caracas and to talk. And it's interesting that all of a sudden, the corporate media rediscovered the term president when they're referring to Maduro. So Maduro is no longer just the strongman or the authoritarian leader. Now he's the president. It's amazing how none of the coverage is actually driven by any principle. It's just whatever the State Department says. So yes, this was a delegation led by this White House Latin America advisor, Juan Gonzalez, who is a bit of a jerk. Also James Story, who is the pretend ambassador to Venezuela because there are no diplomatic relations. And they met with Maduro and the head of the National Assembly, Jorge Rodriguez, for a couple of hours on Saturday evening. And there were some, I mean, the ubiquitous anonymous sources who pepper the corporate media reports. And they were saying that the U.S. delegation had a quote-unquote maximalist demand. They wanted the Venezuelan government to denounce Russia. They wanted reforms to legislation to favor foreign oil corporations. And what was, the always present quote-unquote electoral guarantees. And it wasn't really clear what they offered in exchange. I mean, Reuters said they offered a temporary return to the SWIFT system, which is, I mean, the economic version of peanuts, whereas Maduro, as expected, demanded broader sanctions relief and the return of stolen assets like the US-based oil subsidiary, Citgo. And another aspect in discussion were these US citizens who are currently arrested in Venezuela. The highest profile, of course, are these two mercenaries who took part in this spectacular failure of a mercenary invasion, which was Operation Gideon. We had an episode on that, which I'm sure many of our listeners will remember. But there are also six oil executives that were arrested for corruption. And so that was also a topic of discussion. So this was what we came out from the US side. And on the Venezuelan side, it was complete silence until last night, when Maduro addressed the country with one of his typical long press conferences. And the major announcements he made was that there was going to be a renewed dialogue process with the opposition, but it's still not clear what that means. He mentioned a wider, more inclusive dialogue. So, I mean, my interpretation is that this is going to go beyond Guaido. So this is going to be a gradual phasing out of Guaido. And I'll come back to this point in just a second. And he also mentioned he acknowledged the talks with the U.S. delegation. He said they were diplomatic and respectful, and that this would continue on. I mean, in the future, no specifics. The thing about Guaido is that the corporate media reports said that he was notified once the U.S. delegation was already here, and you can tell that this was a shock. I mean, now he has to search for a real job, because he hasn't tweeted since Friday. So he's trying to figure out if he still has a job or not. But this was the ultimate slap in the face. I mean, I'm sure right now that there will be some kind of backtracking and trying to say that, oh no, we're still working with him. But I mean, you can't really say that this guy is a legitimate president and then you don't even stop by for coffee when you're in town.
Yeah, I mean, it's also like, who was the guy pushing for Guaido so much? It was the previous administration, right? Like, this is you live and die by the sword of Regime Change Inc. Like, this is what happens, is that there's a change in Washington, and all of a sudden, you're not number one. Although, was he a holdover from Obama days? I don't know, Guaido. Did he have a career before Trump? The Trump era, I mean?
No, he's very much a Trump idea. And not just Trump, but all these other people from the Trump White House, like John Bolton, because he was virtually unknown before January 2019. So that's when he burst on the scene. The thing with Guaido is that, I mean, as you were saying, he is a holdover from the Trump administration. And it was clear from the beginning that these Biden people, who are also hawks, but perhaps a more sophisticated brand of imperialist, they were not happy with Guaido, but they didn't have a very clear way to get rid of him, because, I mean, after you go so far and you claim that this guy is the legitimate president, you can't just do a U-turn and dump him. So it was clear that they were always looking for some way to change course. And you can actually see whenever there are these Senate hearings and these most Gusano senators grill the State Department officials, like this Western Hemisphere guy, Brian Nichols. And the response is always that the position hasn't changed. So it isn't exactly an enthusiastic endorsement of Guaido, rather a confession that we have nothing better at the time. But right now, because there's just so much attention on Ukraine, I think the Biden administration is trying to see if it can effectively switch tactics, switch gears. I mean, regime change is always the ultimate goal, but perhaps change plan, like Obama did with Cuba, right? I mean, it wasn't exactly driven by any kind of principle, but switch plans to something that will, at least in their mind, have greater chances of success in the long run. So I think that's why politically they decided to do it now. But also, I mean, the fallout from the conflict in Ukraine, I mean, these soaring energy prices, oil and natural gas, and all of a sudden, people in Washington remember that there are huge oil reserves in Venezuela. So, you know, let's go talk to this guy. Maybe he's not so bad. And that's what they were discussing. I mean, this idiotic press secretary, Jen Psaki, was kind of doing her best mumbo jumbo act to try and spin this visit. But ultimately, it's about trying to figure out their long-term energy reliance away from Russia. I mean, we can talk about this, what this means in practice, but I think that's more or less the gist of it.
So can we expect the return of Venezuelan oil? I mean, this is the question. How many barrels per day can Venezuela put out for export? I mean, isn't there problems meeting domestic demand?
Yeah, I mean, that's the many million dollar question. When the oil embargo, when the US imposed an oil embargo against Venezuela in January 2019, Venezuela was exporting 500,000 barrels a day to these Gulf of Mexico refineries. Right now, total production is perhaps between 700,000 and 800,000 barrels a day. So even if the US market suddenly reopens, I mean, it's not clear how much. I mean, Venezuela can, of course, redirect its crude exports towards the US, and it's much more convenient from an economic standpoint because it's much closer. But in terms of significantly ramping up production, there are many reasons why this is not going to happen in the short term. I mean, certainly not in a window of weeks. It will take months and significant investment because, I mean, oil pumps and oil facilities are not something that you can just, you know, hit the breaker and it starts working again. I mean, it requires maintenance and so on. So it's not going to be any ramp up of production is going to take some time. So that's why, at least for me, it was a bit surprising that Washington would just do such a bold thing as coming to Caracas when there is no clear near-term way for Venezuela to offset whatever might be lost from Russia.
So this isn't the only interesting change in recent months in Venezuela, is that we've seen a drastic improvement in the inflation situation. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yes, that has been remarkable. I'm actually writing a piece right now about the latest economic indicators. So inflation in February was 2.9%, and that's the lowest value since February 2014, so 8 years. And there have also been six straight months of single-digit inflation, which, I mean, for other countries might not seem like a big deal, but here it's also the first time since the first half of 2015 when that's happened. And basically, when we had the worst of the crisis here, which was perhaps from mid-2017 until, let's say, the beginning of last year, what you had was a complete out-of-control inflation devaluation spiral. So you had the local currency, the Bolivar, was devaluing, and that was one of the main factors driving inflation. And so, I mean, there wasn't any kind of stability for economic activity. We can question the way the government has gone about to try and get this under control. And this has been, to a large extent, kind of orthodox path of you know, reducing spending as much as possible, tightening the amount of credit that's available to really get inflation under control. And now that they have, they are loosening some of that to try and boost more economic activity, because the lowered inflation together with the recovery in oil production. So oil production hit historic lows in the second half of 2020 and nearly doubled in the 12 months that followed to this level where we are right now of around 700,000 barrels a day. So that recovery, along with the stability of the reduced inflation, was enough for the country to have economic growth for the first time since 2014. So it had like 4% economic growth. And there are perspectives that it will be, I don't know, maybe 6%, maybe 8% this year, which, I mean, there's still a long way to go. We're talking about an economy that shrunk by, I don't know, 3/4 in the last 8 years. So there's a lot to recover. But at least there are positive signs. And now the government is trying to address some of the casualties of this effort to tame inflation. So I was saying that they tightened spending, and that meant wages were incredibly low, I mean, at almost unspeakably low levels, which meant that people were relying on relatives sending remittances from abroad or from picking up extra jobs in the private sector. But last weekend, there was like a 20-fold increase of the minimum wage, which is still at $30, so nowhere near covering living costs. But at least it means that there is some kind of macroeconomic stability that allows for the government to now hopefully recover incomes and kind of boost more economic activity without going back into this out of control inflationary spiral. And if there's any perspective of sanctions relief, then of course a whole new dimension for economic recovery opens. But I mean, that's still not clear whether that's in the horizon for the near future. I think that's going to be a bit of a carrot and stick game that Washington is going to play. But I mean, at least even under these very harsh circumstances, the fact that the economy has managed to stabilize and recover has been impressive. And it's not like everyone is benefiting equally, but at least you can see very, very clear signs that, you know, things have started to turn around. Now, how sustainable it can be, it remains the open question.